You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
We had a very nice dinner, and at that time he told me, you are not under investigation, which I knew anyway.
Oh, yes, you are. Multiple sources suggest that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is investigating President Donald Trump over a potential obstruction of justice. My guests Lindy Yu and Jeffrey Howard will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull's foray into stand-up comedy, Japan's controversial anti-terror law, are mushroom pickers and boat racers really that much of a threat, and the surprise resignation of UK Liberal Democrat leader Tim Farron, citing a clash between faith and politics. But is that his problem or ours?
I seem to have been the subject of suspicion because of what I believe and who my faith is in. In which case, we are kidding ourselves if we think we yet live in a tolerant, liberal society.
That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Lindy Yu, the economist and broadcaster, and Jeffrey Howard, lecturer in political theory at University College London. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the United States, where it is being plausibly reported by multiple sources that President Donald Trump is, in fact, being investigated by Special Counsel Robert Mueller for possible obstruction of justice, which is to say that Trump's sacking of the last FBI director, rather, of the FBI, is now being investigated by the director of the FBI before that, until or unless Trump sacks him as well. Linda, we have had some response, unsurprisingly, from Trump online. He said they made up a phony collusion with the Russian story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice. The thing is, does he actually have potentially half a point here? Because there is thus far an awful lot of smoke but no actual fire.
I think probably, as with all these things, it's always the, I don't want to use the word cover up, but it's always the follow-up action that's the problem. So we don't really, the investigation into Russia's impact on the U.S. election that's ongoing. We know that the American Senate has actually passed more sanctions against Russia for those interfering acts. However, if you think back to Watergate, which is obviously what many people will now think of.
Increasingly wistfully, yeah.
it is always the action of afterwards. So did President Trump tell James Comey to drop the investigation into, Michael Flynn, who we know was obviously involved somehow, it seemed. And so I think that's where the obstruction of justice claim, I think, is coming from. And just to give you a sense of significance, obstruction of justice is a very serious allegation. And if Trump testifies, as he says he 100% will, that raises the stakes, because perjury plus obstruction, those were exactly the two things that felled Bill Clinton when he was impeached by the House, but not by the Senate.
I'm sticking with my pet theory that we have embarked into a bizarre hall of mirrors in which I'm trying to see if I can remember how this all goes now, because it's acquiring a certain circular logic by which Russia never actually hacked the election or interfered with the election, but enjoyed creating the impression that they had. And Trump, therefore, doesn't actually have anything to cover up. But in covering up the nothing that he didn't do wrong, he actually does the thing that gets him hounded out of office.
That actually made sense, Andrew.
Yeah, did it actually make sense?
Yes, your hall of mirrors made sense.
I'm not sure I actually understand it myself.
I think it makes sense. I'm not sure it's plausible to think that Russia didn't intervene in the election at all.
I know, I just kind of like the idea that they said, let's just not do it, and then kind of say we did.
Yeah, I mean, I think
it'll drive them nuts.
I think what's more plausible is that there was no actual collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, or at the very least that Donald Trump himself was unaware of any collusion should it have taken place. I think the fact that the intimations of Russian collusion seem to taint the legitimacy of Trump's presidency might itself explain why Trump is so put off by talk about Russia and why he's so upset about it, not because he's hiding anything necessarily. But I think you're right. It seems wholly plausible that the president has committed obstruction of justice, and it shouldn't be too surprising because that's basically what he told us he did. He said that James Comey was looking into Russia, was looking into Michael Flynn. He told him to stop looking into Michael Flynn. He didn't stop looking into Michael Flynn, and then he fired him.
I do find it necessary to remind myself about half a dozen times a day that this is actually happening. Linda, according to the reporting, which is being reported by multiple sources, all of which have their own sources independent of each other. So the administration is continuing to leak. I don't even know if it's leaking like a sieve. It's like just leaking like a kind of handle with a ring on it and actually nothing in it. It just, everything just goes straight through. But it suggests that senior intelligence officials will be interviewed specifically about that, whether Trump tried to spike the investigation into Michael Flynn. What happens if these senior intelligence sources just say, yeah, that's absolutely what happened, that's what he did?
Then I think there would be grounds for an obstruction of justice charge against the president. I think I suppose Trump's reaction will be very important, because the reason I was saying earlier about his willingness to testify under oath, he can say whatever he wants on Twitter. He can say whatever he wants in public. But under the American legal system, if he were to lie under oath and he was contradicted by say it turned out to be the case that he really, that was the reason why he fired James Comey and he's essentially perjured himself, I think that gives you multiple grounds to think that he's really in trouble. And so I don't know if he'll testify. We don't really know whether or not he's just, quote, a newbie that Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, described him as, that there's no malintent here. But in a legalistic way, it doesn't really matter. You either obstructed justice or you didn't. And if you're going to testify to deny that, then you'd be lying under oath. And perjury is a, as I said, thinking back to Bill Clinton's days. And he, Bill Clinton, recall, committed perjury over an affair he didn't want to admit to. This would be perjury against something which is actually quite a serious allegation, firing the FBI director. So,
on which subject, Jeffrey, it is a preposterous notion, obviously, but Donald Trump is, if nothing else, capable of doing six preposterous things before breakfast. Would he dare now sack Robert Mueller?
Oh, I think this president is wholly unpredictable. It's totally possible he'd do that. I think it's probably unlikely at this moment that he'd fire Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller, of course, is widely respected on both sides of the aisle. He was very respected as an FBI director. Just picking up this last point that Linda's made, I mean, I think it seems pretty clear that if Robert Mueller publicly declares that there's sufficient evidence to bring an obstruction of justice charge against Donald Trump, against the president of the United States, this will totally shift the political scene. Now, I don't think we'd actually see an indictment. The Supreme Court hasn't ruled on this, but most American lawyers think that the president of the United States is immune from criminal prosecution, so that there wouldn't actually be any police going into the White House and arresting Donald Trump. Most lawyers think that the Constitution immunizes the executive from this kind of criminal prosecution simply because the executive branch couldn't function very well if 12 jurors could themselves undo the results of a presidential election. But the ramifications, as Linda points out, are political ramifications. Would it become unviable for Republicans to support the president of the United States if Robert Mueller came to this conclusion? And if that becomes true, then it's very possible that impeachment charges will be drawn up. If not, then we have to wait till 2018. And if the Democrats come in then they certainly will bring in the charges.
Linda, final thought on this before we move on slightly. Trump is now polling at 39% for, 55% against, which are catastrophic numbers, especially this early in an administration. And the numbers appear to be getting further apart. Do we get the sense that Americans are beginning to tire of the show?
Probably no. He's always had these very, very low and getting worse ratings. But if you look at the support and financial support being given to the Republican Party, I think that's actually increased quite a lot. So I think what you're picking up on the polling is the polarization of the American electorate. Obviously, the Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. He won the Electoral College. There's a lot of Americans who are seeing what's happening here, and I think they're becoming more and more disenchanted. The key is absolutely Trump voters. How do they feel he's doing? And the Republican-controlled Congress, this is a midterm election next year. So depending on Trump's favorable ratings, I think that will largely determine what happens with this entire case, as Jeffrey's also mentioned. The politics of it, I think, hinge heavily on how popular Trump is and if he's raising money for the entire House of Representatives, 435 people who are facing re-election next year, and a third of the Senate.
Okay, well, let's move along slightly, because if Donald Trump seeks a headline-grabbing diversion from his present woes, he may have been conveniently provided with a casus belli by Australia, whose Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has been caught making fun of the President at what he supposed was an off-the-record event at Parliament House in Canberra. It is difficult to imagine that Trump, who is known for his thick skin in the same way that he is known for his normal-coloured skin and normal-sized hands, will have been amused. Here is some of Turnbull's Trump impression.
Donald and I, we are winning and winning in the polls. We are winning so much. We are winning like we have never won before. We are winning in the polls. We are. Not the fake polls. Not the fake polls.
Should, though, Jeffrey, my homeland's prime minister, stick with the day job? Do you think he displayed any talent?
I don't think it was a great impression. But I think the most telling thing to learn about this is that there's very little likelihood that Donald Trump will find this funny. We know that Donald Trump just doesn't have a sense of humor. George W. Bush, great sense of humor. Barack Obama, great sense of humor. Donald J. Trump, terrible sense of humor. There was a Comedy Central roast of Donald Trump a few years back, and as far as I recall, he barely cracked a smile during it. Well, he can crack a smile, but he doesn't laugh. We don't see him laugh very often.
No, he was also famously unamused, of course, when Barack Obama lit into him at that White House correspondence dinner a few years back. And this event at which Malcolm Turnbull was speaking is broadly speaking, the Australian equivalent of that. It's the midwinter ball, as it's known. We know that the jokes were made because the audio was leaked by a very distinguished Australian journalist called Laurie Oakes, who doesn't go to the dinner because he doesn't like the idea of journalists being off the record. Was he right to do that? Should the Prime Minister and the people report on him be entitled, Linda, to have a bit of a jape among themselves in private?
Well, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is the equivalent in America, is on the record.
Indeed.
And it is a roast. But I suppose in the Australian context, which I'm sure, Andrew, you know better than that's your home country, if something is off the record and somebody leaks it, I guess the question is, should the journalists have respected the off the record, or just did what that journalist Laurie that you mentioned did, which is just to not go because they objected? So I think that's probably one of the issues. I did hear some of the audio of the roast myself earlier, and my favorite bit was the this is beautiful, you know, the meeting with, you know, Turnbull. I just thought, I think given Trump's treatment of the Australian Prime Minister, including reportedly shouting at him over the phone over refugee policy, and then finally making nice, I think if you've been treated that roughly, I mean, this is beyond how diplomacy normally works, obviously. I suppose Malcolm Turnbull just felt he needed to stick it to Trump a little bit.
Well, Malcolm Turnbull has claimed both that the jokes were ultimately at his own expense, and also that any mocking of Donald Trump was in the manner of affectionate joshing. But Jeffrey, is there a serious point here? Because obviously, as Australia and the United States are extremely close allies, though I suspect that relationship is rather more important to Australia than it is to the United States. But are we trying too hard if we look for a serious point here? Because I cannot think, scrolling back through the years, of I can't imagine another Australian Prime Minister mocking his contemporary or her contemporary president of the United States in this fashion. I cannot imagine Bob Hawke making this sort of fun of Ronald Reagan or Paul Keating making this sort of fun of George W. Bush, etc., etc., etc.
I think we live in a pretty dangerous world, and so I think it's generally not appropriate for leaders to be making fun of each other in this way, certainly not in settings where there was a great risk that it would come out. But I think Donald Trump has set the standard here, right? Donald Trump has, I think, largely degenerated the civility of public discourse to such a degree that he certainly can't complain if other leaders follow suit.
I'm sure he will,
because I think that based on the evidence we have, it looks like the president finds it difficult to distinguish between affectionate joshing, as you put it, and genuine
pretty sure it wasn't
barbing.
Affectionate joshing.
Well, no, but even if it is affectionate joshing, it's not clear the president can take a joke here. And I think that's a problem, because I think one of the things we want in a political leader is a really thick skin. And I think we should be very suspicious of political leaders who don't have a thick skin, because it means that they're easily rattled, they're easily thrown off whatever their main objective is. And I think this will just provide more evidence of that. And just wait for the tweet. I'm sure Donald Trump is going to tweet something about this at some point.
One can only hope. Linda, there is another, I think, serious point underpinning this. And we've seen glimmers. I rather suspect that Malcolm Turnbull has said out loud what an awful lot of other world leaders have been thinking. Because we've seen glimmers of this in people's baffled body language during Trump's recent tour of the Middle East and of Europe especially. Is it damaging to the United States if much of the rest of the world, especially the rest of the world's leadership, finds the president genuinely ridiculous?
I think that Donald Trump, he is the elected president of the United States, and some say he's elected because of the way he is. So,
no doubt at all.
Yeah, because one thing about him is that on the campaign trail and in office, he is who he is. And so I guess from that sense, we may just have to rethink our use of the term description presidential. It's obviously changed now. But I take the broader point, which is if Donald Trump doesn't respect decorum, and that's what I kind of meant by kind of diplomatic language-wise, it's very unusual to hear a leader, even off the record, make fun of another world leader, because there's a high degree of decorum and diplomacy involved in all of this. I think, for me, the danger is for European and Middle Eastern leaders not to take the President of the United States' word on things, because they don't, there's no rapport, they don't necessarily trust they are building a relationship. And in fact, I remember on his European tour, when Vice President Mike Pence actually tried to clarify and said, Trump does support, remember he didn't support NATO until he went back to Washington, D.C., or something along those lines. And one European policymaker said, well, I guess that's the position until the next tweet.
Yes, this is apparently the world we now live in. On that happy thought, we are going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Linda Yu and Jeffrey Howard. Coming up next, Japan and its new anti-terror legislation.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Linda Yu and Jeffrey Howard. Let's look now at Japan, which has become the latest of the world's democracies to react to the threat of terrorist attack by becoming less democratic. Apparently concerned by the prospect of terrorism up to and during the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, the government has passed a broad new law, rather too broad, some have argued, empowering it to crack down on criminal conspiracies, including obvious big-ticket items like terrorism, but also some charmingly arcane offences, including racing motorboats without a licence and picking mushrooms in protected forests. Linda, is this one of those occasions where terrorism is the excuse rather than the reason for a new law?
It certainly sounds like it. It sounds actually a bit like the anti-cartel authority that American lawmakers used. So in other words, if you're trying to, in the American context, they were trying to get at organized crime. And so the way to do it is almost through a back door where they give expanded powers to govern cartels. And that's roughly what it sounds like in the Japanese case. I think they are probably trying to do a number of things. My favorite offense on this list that would be covered by the new legislation is failure to pay consumption tax. Now, that's actually a big issue in Japan because they don't collect, I find it very hard to raise consumption tax, the rate. And there's a signal that they are actually using this broader authority to not just tackle terrorism, but also to do other things that they probably feel they haven't been able to do.
Jeffrey, Japan is an orderly country. It's not a crime-free Arcadia, but it is an orderly country in which terrorism, as we understand it, is almost unheard of. That being the case, why is this necessary?
Well, I think the Japanese government is doing in this case what policymakers across the world want to do in response to the risk of criminal activity, especially terrorist activity, which is try to find a way where we can arrest people before they've actually committed a terrorist attack. So essentially what this does,
an obvious problem,
increases the list of inchoate crimes, acts that don't themselves cause any direct harm, but are essential steps in the run-up to committing a criminal offense. So conspiracy being the paradigmatic case of an inchoate crime, encouraging someone to commit a criminal offense. In this case, procuring the funds or the supplies that you'll then use to commit a criminal offense. So basically just bloating the criminal law out of proportion so that we can increase the number of people that we can incarcerate, and in particular, identify a moment in the process well before the commission of an actual, in this case, terrorist offense where they can be arrested.
Linda, I'm issuing a rider to this next question, which is that it is in no way intended as a glib point, especially here in the United Kingdom, having suffered a series of extremely serious terrorist attacks in recent months. But for any given citizen of any developed country, the statistical chances of being directly affected by terrorism are infinitesimal compared to all the other things that could befall you. Do governments pay it too much attention?
I would say no, because I think what terrorism we see is probably the tip of the iceberg. I think there has been a worrying rise in terms of, for lack of a better word, terrorists who are motivated by ideology. So I think all of these things are a real social issue, and I don't know the best solution for it. As Jeffrey said, I think lawmakers would like to do what actually that Tom Cruise movie, Minority Report, did, which is to have precogs that could predict whether or not you are going to commit an offense. And I think in Japan's case, as you rightly say, they're actually quite a law-abiding nation. They are relatively, in this context, they're luckier than we are here. They are concerned. Cybersecurity is another area where governments are clamping down. They think it leads to criminal activity. There's also more issues around how much government can do before the act of a crime. And that's where I think the Japanese case is also headed. I just think they probably cast the net too wide in their ambition to do so, catching everybody from mushrooms to consumption tax to all this kind of stuff.
Okay, well, finally tonight, I want to look at the UK, where Liberal Democrat leader Tim Farron has become an unexpected casualty of last week's election, resigning his position despite doing creditably well, his party winning 12 seats after being reduced to 8 in 2015. They had picked up a ninth along the way. Mr. Farron had squirmed awkwardly during the campaign when pressed on his views vis-à-vis homosexuality. In his resignation statement, he said he found himself torn between being a faithful Christian, as he saw it, and being a political leader. Jeffrey, I've read Tim Farron's statement several times now. I'm bound to say it doesn't make a great deal of sense to me. Did it to you?
I'm completely perplexed by this. So he says, we're kidding ourselves if we think we live in a liberal, intolerant society. And part of me just wonders whether Farron has just completely misunderstood what the point of a liberal, intolerant society is. Now, I take it that the point of a society like ours is that people are free to pursue their own visions of what a good and meaningful and religiously worthwhile life is, so long as they respect the rights of others to do the same. It doesn't mean that you're have a right to be insulated from others' criticism, that you've gone down the wrong path. No religious person has a right to be insulated by criticism from atheists, and vice versa. So if his problem is essentially that people have told him, look, Tim Farron, we disagree about your fundamental views about how human beings should live their lives, even if we agree with you on matters of politics, this just is what living in a free society is. It's a big debate about how we should organize our lives that happens within the contours of a set of basic rules that respect us all as equals.
Yeah, it was strange, Linda. It seemed strange to me that he was sort of expressing outrage that a lot of people think his views are weird. It struck me that maybe the more proper response would be to reflect on maybe whether his views are in fact weird.
I think there's something to be said for separating religion and politics. I still remember, do you recall under Tony Blair, when he was asked about his religious beliefs.
Indeed.
And Alistair Campbell at the time said, we don't do God.
Alistair Campbell all but leaping across an aircraft and rugby tackling the journalist in question to the ground, as I recall.
And so I think in this case, I think Tim Farron is obviously having a personal struggle in terms of his, I think he's a born again Christian, his beliefs against what he thinks he can do for his party to represent it. So he's obviously unable to make that separation. And actually, some politicians can and others can't. I think there's quite a lot to be said for being able to essentially know that values inform your views, but personal views versus a party's platform. I think you need to be able to reconcile that. So I guess in that sense, I'm not surprised he's probably decided he's not able to lead his party, but making a wider social statement, I don't think that was necessary.
I mean, the great strangeness of this is that up until now, he seemed to have been balancing it quite well, in that he said what he said and said what he believed. I thought, quite honestly, I may happen to think those views were, as I said, weird, but fine, they're his views. But as a leader of a Liberal Democrat Party, he actually seemed pretty good at representing that in public and indeed in Parliament. His voting record on things like gay marriage is pretty solid.
Yeah, I mean, I think a liberal religious citizen can come in two different flavors. One kind of flavor is a person who sharply separates their personal convictions about religion and other issues from their political convictions. But the other kind of liberal religious citizen is someone whose religion is what itself directs him or her to be a liberal Democrat. So their understanding of their own religion moves them to believe in equal rights for all. And I would have thought that Tim Farron was the latter. He had a kind of seamless integration of his religious and public moral views. But the most recent comments suggest that he might have been the former. So he might have been actually torn or split between his personal convictions about religious life and his public convictions about politics. But I'm not sure which one it might be.
I mean, Linda, do you think we are, in fact, rather than too pushy about questioning politicians on their religious beliefs, not pushy enough? I sort of tend to think it allows a lot of politicians to wall off a lot of their beliefs in a protected space where they feel that any questioning of that is bad taste. When Mitt Romney was running for president, I don't recall one serious question about his Mormon faith and how it informed his politics.
I have some sympathy to that, because if it is the latter kind of person, as Jeffrey has just described, then their religious views will affect their policy stance. And actually, the person who comes to mind right now is Vice President Michael Pence of the United States, who is religiously conservative. He's Christian. And if you look at the abortion legislation that's just been pushed through, it is actually coming through in terms of policy. So I think in that case, we should be asking questions if that is their voting record.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Linda Yu and Jeffrey Howard, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. And Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. Do tune in. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.